If it wasn't the Rothschilds, it would be somebody else. It's the system which allows the Rothschilds to do those things, and if it wasn't them, it would be somebody else. I mean, JP Morgan is not Rothschild. They have their own nefarious activities going on, and no doubt there are struggles at the top between various factions.
But there also must be collusion between some of the big houses too.
Yes, indeed. But look at the way Lehman Brothers were hung out to dry. They weren't sufficiently in the loop to be protected, whereas Goldman Sachs was. These are palace revolutions, you know, fights at the top, which the outside world doesn't really know what's going on, who's winning, who's losing, how the policy is being determined.
So
but the real problem is the system. They shouldn't be allowed to make money like this.
We've got to the state now where these dynasties are the true rulers of the world rather than the governments that we elect.
Well, they always were. Let's face it, democracy is a very recent invention and rather weak. Historically, societies have generally been run by the wealthy and powerful. Look back through history, you'll find your Henry VIII, your Hitlers, your Mussolinis and so on. I mean, democracy is actually rather the exception, although people imagine that it's the rule. It's not the rule at all, and democracy is always very weak. The powerful are the powerful. Democracy is some kind of check on their power, and of course it's got weaker and weaker as the power at the top in the hands of the wealthy has got stronger. I mean, that's what's happened in the last generation. They've got stronger rather than weaker.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Okay, sorry for interrupting you there, Martin. You're just finishing your final little flurry. But the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists for the last 10 years has been Jeremy Deer, but he's leaving to make way for the NUJ's first ever woman boss. He knows as much as almost anyone in the country about the state of Britain's media from a writer's point of view, rather than from that of the media editors, managers and owners. So let's have a listen to Jeremy's final speech to conference, a journalist's eye view of Britain's media you will not hear on any other radio station.
Jeremy Deer, General Secretary, moving. Moving for the final time, annual report section 2. Comrades, if we needed any more proof that George Osborne's big lie that we are all in this together was so glaringly untrue, today is the day. As EU finance ministers tell us deep and damaging cuts are the only option, another city firm is announcing increased bonuses for financiers and speculators. George Osborne insists cuts in jobs, public services, pay and pensions are essential to bail out bankrupt Britain. And so, hundreds of thousands of public sector jobs are to be axed, with equivalent numbers lost in the private sector. And the price we are told we must pay include a tax on affordable social housing, billions of pounds of cuts in welfare, massive cuts in arts and leisure funding, education being priced out of the reach of students from less wealthy backgrounds, councils forced into having to make cuts in frontline services, and public bodies being axed, leading to less regulation just at the time we need more of it. And maybe the most pernicious of all the attacks, the idea that more than 1 million people on employment and support allowance must find work in 12 months or face a cut in their benefits at a time when millions are already out of work and more job cuts are to follow. One thing is clear. This is not just trimming back on the fat of a bloated public sector. It is a fundamental attack on the welfare state. And the very idea that this is a price worth paying or that must be paid is one of a number of myths being peddled by government. So let's just smash some of those myths here. The myth that the public sector is to blame for this crisis. We are in debt, not because firefighters put out too many fires, or teachers educated too many students, or nurses treated too many people who are sick, but because the profit at all cost greed of the bankers sparked a recession. Bailing out the banks cost us £1.3 trillion. People working to provide public services did not cause this crisis and should not have to pay for it. (Applause) And what about that myth that we're all in this together? We're not. While pay freezes and job cuts hit public and private sector workers, bonuses for UK executives continue to rise by 17% in the last year alone. Profits as a share of national income are at a 40-year high, while wages are at a 40-year low. Last year, the 1,000 richest people in the UK increased their personal wealth by £77 billion. Just half their fortunes could pay off the entire national debt. We are not broke. The money is in the wrong hands. And above all, we must smash the myth that there is no alternative. These cuts are a political choice. There is an alternative, and it could start with putting an end to tax evasion, which loses us £75 billion a year, or the tax avoidance, which costs us £30 billion. Reversing the lowering of corporation tax would bring in an additional £15 billion, and the Robin Hood tax, a tiny tax on global financial transactions, would raise a further £250 billion annually. And we must take on the myth, too, that a response to the crisis which involves cutting public sector pay and pensions, attacking welfare benefits, education and transport will lead us to recovery. It hasn't in Greece, and you ask our comrades in Ireland whether it succeeded for them. It has deepened the crisis. Spending in the public sector creates jobs in the private sector. And so whether on the March for the Alternative or the Better Fairer Way campaign, we have taken our banners to the streets of Dublin, Glasgow, Cardiff, London, Belfast and towns and cities across this union. As Pete said, we have marched together. Now we must be prepared to strike together too. And we do so not just because we have a passionate belief in economic and social justice, but because these cuts also hit our members hard. At the BBC, they were used as a justification for the pensions robbery unveiled last year. The backdrop to the craven submission by BBC management to government demands for a frozen licence fee coupled with massive new spending commitments. The excuse used for the closure of language services and the axing of hundreds of jobs at the World Service and monitoring. Now they are the justification as we face the Orwellian newspeak of delivering quality first, which will cut 20% from BBC spending, threatening thousands more jobs and services. And if we are all in this together, how come BBC bosses are still getting £500,000 in bonuses? If we're all in this together, how come BBC bosses are retiring with £1 million+ payoffs? If we're all in this together, how come some BBC bosses are getting double-digit pay rises at a time of pay freezes for more than a third of staff? And how come at monitoring or the World Service, it is hundreds of frontline reporters, producers and news gatherers, not senior managers, who disproportionately face the chop? And while the BBC considers plans to cut programme making and threaten the future of local radio, they spend £10 million a year on private sector consultants, employ six of the top 10 highest paid HR executives in the UK, and pay senior managers upwards of £50 million a year. Not just this year, year on year. And yet they tell us there is no alternative to their cuts. Well, let the BBC hear this well. We will not stand idly by while you wreck services and force skilled staff out of their jobs. We showed in the face of the pensions robbery we were willing, ready and able to fight to defend our terms and conditions. And so we stand today, ready, willing and able to fight compulsory redundancies and to defend services at the BBC. But the BBC is not the only place that jobs and terms and conditions have been the victims of economic crisis or such corporate greed and rank hypocrisy has been on display, or where union resistance has made a difference. At NewsQuest, at Johnston Press, at Trinity Mirror, at Northcliffe, across books, magazines, commercial broadcasting and new media, pay freezes, job culls, attacks on freelance rates and rights, title closures, the axing of editions and specialists are just the latest visible manifestations of an industry beset by corporate failure and unbridled greed. The picket lines, the lobbies of shareholder meetings, the demonstrations at company HQs and the public protests are the visible manifestation of our rejection of their corporate vandalism. And as Sly Bailey and Paul Davidson and other media executives receive increased pay, bonuses and pension payments, is it any wonder journalists ask, what kind of a system is it that rewards the boss of a news organisation for sacking journalists, closing papers and losing readers? In the face of so much bad news, it is sometimes possible to think there is nothing we can do. This union and its members continue to prove, even in the direst economic circumstances, our collective action makes a difference. From Glyn Roberts' court case to the picket lines at the BBC Arabic service, from the securing of new jobs at Alpha Newspapers to defending jobs at Clyde and Forth Press, from the resistance of rights grabs at Bauer to securing holiday pay for freelancers at Al Jazeera, this union makes a difference. And we've shown over the past 18 months that our commitment to fight for journalists and journalism stretches from starting out in your career to retirement. We've hit the headline defending pensions, and as Pete has said, now we are taking up with greater vigour the campaign to end the abuse of work experience and the exploitation of unpaid labour. Our union's been at the forefront of that campaign for years, and now, alongside London Freelance Branch, we launched a new initiative, Cashback for Interns, with the first test cases against media companies who breach the national minimum wage legislation now in the courts. And I welcome this week's report from the Low Pay Commission, in part informed by the evidence that I was able to present alongside Bechtu and interns themselves at the Commission and directly to the Deputy Prime Minister, which calls for HMRC to crack down on non-payment of the national minimum wage. It is long overdue, but with HMRC facing job cuts and too few inspectors, we cannot rely solely on others to help us stop this abuse. And so from Parliament, to the workplace, to the courts, we remain committed to campaigning and acting to end this exploitation. Those who unlawfully exploit the dreams of young journalists looking for their first step on the career ladder should be clear. There are now no more hiding places. I've always wanted to say this to them, but see you in court. And yet another example of our union standing up for journalists and journalism and our action making a difference. Ask Charles Atangana whether we make a difference. A leading Cameroonian journalist, set upon by President Biya's security forces, arrested, stripped naked, beaten up and detained for 40 days, locked in a flooded cell and tortured to try to force him to reveal his sources. He refused. Suffering from malnutrition and food poisoning, Charles managed to persuade his captors to take him to hospital. Through bribery, he managed to escape. On his release, he continued to face death threats. He fled to the UK, somewhere he believed was a sanctuary for freedom of speech. He remains here, thanks to the work of the Glasgow branch in particular, initially, and the rest of the union following on. But he still faces deportation. And we must pledge here today our continued support for Charles's fight and for all those NUJ members still fighting the barbarity of the threat of deportation. And today we should also take the opportunity to pay a public tribute to all those trade unionists who 25 years ago stood out and stood up to the world's most powerful media magnate, who, backed by the courts, the police, much of the media, and a viciously anti-union government personified by Norman Tebbit and Margaret Thatcher, sought so brutally to break the power of the unions. The defiance and resistance of all those trade unionists continues to inspire me and so many others today. And that dispute had enormous consequences for so many individuals, but it had a wider significance too. Whilst the strike ended after a long, brutal year, the consequences of Murdoch's actions are still felt in every newsroom and every media company today. Whopping delivered newspapers into the hands of corporations and accountants. And other employers rushed to exploit the opportunities the assault on the unions opened up. When it comes to cutting costs and creaming off bigger profits, newspaper bosses followed Murdoch's example. And we see the consequences of that today. Wages for journalists slumped. Staff shortages mean far too many journalists are desk-bound. Instead of investing in quality journalism, reporters and specialists are increasingly forced to spend all day at their desks because it's cheaper and more productive, and rely more and more on second-hand facts, corporate, celebrity and political PR. The scrutiny of power and democratic accountability suffer. And while the media industry delivered year-on-year record profits, the corporate business model began killing journalism, cutting at what is perceived to be expensive, investigative, international and original news gathering. It is that vision of a compliant, corporate, profit-at-all-cost journalism at the expense of truth or journalistic ethics, which so many people stood against 25 years ago. And it is a stand a new generation are making again today. And there could not be a more important time for us to be making that stand. Whopping opened the door to Murdoch to grab power. He has consistently used and abused his media dominance for his own business ends, buying political favours to suit his own corporate interests. But whilst politicians and those in power have prostrate themselves time and time again in the face of that power, from the caveats in the Employment Relations Act to the relaxation of media ownership laws, a new resistance has grown. And now he's making his latest power grab with the proposed takeover of Sky B, raising deep public interest issues. The merged company would have a reach of 52% of the adult population, with profound consequences, not just for media plurality, but for our democracy. Figures for news consumption show Sky would have a share more than double its next nearest commercial rival. Merging the first and fourth most dominant news providers warrants more rigorous scrutiny than Jeremy Hunt. Spinning off Sky News for a few years does not adequately address our concerns. Remember the caveats Murdoch gave over the Times, the News of the World or the Wall Street Journal. They were lies designed to provide a fig leaf to politicians and regulators too scared, too corrupt, too reliant on Murdoch's favours to act in the public interest. Sky News will remain under Murdoch's effective economic control, and with economic control comes the threat of editorial control. So that takeover rightly stokes our fears about increasing monopolisation of the media. Too much control in the hands of too few is bad for democracy, and this episode could not demonstrate that more clearly. Murdoch helped secure the election of a government committed to marginalising public service broadcasting whilst allowing him to extend his power. Unminuted meetings and that now infamous Christmas dinner all add to a stench of corruption. All this at a time when claimants in the phone hacking scandal have been bought off. The company's chief executive refuses to attend parliamentary hearings, and more allegations have surfaced about the company paying police officers for information. Officers from the very same force charged with investigating claims of criminality in the News of the World. Never mind referring the matter to the Competition Commission, it is unacceptable that the merger is even being considered while such serious charges are outstanding. But we have a new and important opportunity. The phone hacking scandal, the cloak and dagger negotiations over merger, tax avoidance, the poisonous bile poured forth by parts of Murdoch's empire have awoken a new interest in the role of the media. We have a chance now to shape that debate, and at its heart must be a total rejection of the Murdoch philosophy, so eloquently set out by James Murdoch, that profit is the best guarantor of media quality and independence. It is not. The founders of the free press never thought that freedom of the press would only belong to those who could afford a press. They would have been horrified at the idea that if rich people determine there is not sufficient commercial value in news, that communities should be deprived of quality information and quality journalism. So we need action to save, build and sustain a new media. For years we've warned that profit of all costs model and relentless drive for market share means the truth has too often become expendable, that journalistic ethics can be set aside, and that journalists are forced to cut corners and act against their conscience for fear of losing their job. The arrest of two journalists in the phone hacking scandal proves that point. We should welcome the debate opened up by this latest episode. It strengthens our arguments for a conscience clause, for the need for a new regulatory regime, which does not serve the interests of the media owners, but protects the public interest, and for a commission on media ownership. Such a commission should be charged with promoting alternative models. The union's been at the forefront of that debate over the past 18 months, from the excellent New Ways to Make Journalism Pay conference to the forthcoming conference on alternative models and cooperative publishing. We must continue to lead that debate, stepping up our campaigns for media reform and joining forces with all those citizens who want to extend media democracy, accountability and plurality, and against those who seek to crush it. Comrades, it is for all these reasons and so many more that I have been immensely proud and honoured to lead our union through the period of winning back recognition, rebuilding the union's collective strength and steering it through the biggest economic and structural changes we've ever faced over these past few years. I've been fortunate to have the opportunity to serve the union I love at every level, from FOC to General Secretary, and I thank you and our members for having given me the chance to do so. And I've been fortunate too to stand alongside so many great and dedicated reps, so many people who give freely of their time and effort only so they can help improve the lives of their colleagues, and to work with so many committed and inspirational officials and staff. But there is one person above all I could not have done this without: Paula. She's been a comfort in times of trouble, an inspiration in the heat of battle, and an active member and rep who is constantly asked, what does Jeremy think about this offer, this campaign, this proposal? To which she now replies, I don't know, I haven't decided yet. I see every day, through Paula, what our reps do. The work, the commitment, the support, the counselling, the solidarity, and the success they deliver for members. Day in, day out, week in, week out. The front line in our battle for justice. Paula, thank you for everything you've done for this union, and above all for putting up with everything this union's thrown at us in the last 10 years. Comrades, before us lie great opportunities and serious threats. Anti-terror laws which stifle media freedom, product placement, the economic crisis, all pose threats. The big cable and phone companies that control access to the internet want to be gatekeepers, deciding which websites and services can be used depending on which companies have paid them the most. They want to turn the open internet into a closed, private toll road. And yet new technologies, freed from the stifling constraints imposed by the market, offer us opportunities too. If we are to have public conversations, essential to taking on serious dilemmas, from climate change to economic justice, we need forums for those conversations. The media can facilitate the conversations, or it can shut them down. They can open up or constrain our beliefs about what is possible, what is desirable, who is deserving, and which perspectives are legitimate. Serving democracy and nourishing the common good is, for the media, something that requires not only attacking corrupt secrecies in a society, but also defending non-corrupt communication. Day in, day out, we stand up for journalists, but we must never forget too that we have a historic mission on behalf of the public to stand up for journalism too. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Deer, outgoing General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, speaking this time last week up in Southport at the Union Conference. Now, Martin Summers is just joining me. Briefly, Martin, before the news, one of the most serious things that's come up, and Jeremy mentioned in his speech there, is this becoming clear now that the Metropolitan Police may have been paid, regularly paid, for stories by the Metropolitan Police, who were supposed to be investigating the News of the World at the same time. Now, isn't that a sort of conflict of interest there?
Definitely, and of course what we've got is a phenomenon of media magnates who are overmighty subjects. Think of Mr. Berlusconi. These people are becoming incredibly powerful because they are very, very wealthy and they control the means of communication. I mean, the classic case of overmighty subjects who need to be brought to, you know, they're too big for their boots and they need to be cut down to size.
Interestingly enough, Nick Davis, who gave the Bend lecture last year, actually no, 2009, November, here in Bristol, talked about this story. It seems to be running and running and running, so I'm sure it's not finished yet. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Stoke Bishop, Peter Abraham, to reporter Marina Morris, and guests, Australian child leukaemia paediatrician, Helen Caldicott, and of course to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week it's Good Friday. We'll be back with more politics and controversial investigations in the run-up to the AV referendum and the local elections. You will find this show, podcasts from previous shows, on thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
FM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...